It's Alum Group's Andrea Lay, PacFew's Melissa Burdick, live with me here in Connecticut, the Wizard of Woodland Hills Tree, and I'm PBSB from Flywheel, a division of Omnicom. Before we get to the CPG Guys episode you've downloaded, it's the week of April 15th, and it's time for the Fresh Four. Four curated news stories from the past week. We find them hubristically intriguing. We hope you do too. They're brought to you through our partnership with Retail Wit, your one-stop shop for retail industry intelligence and news. RetailWit.com. It's retail right now. Melissa, kick us off.
Hey, Fresh Four listeners. Dollar General celebrates opening its 20,000th store. There you go, 20,000. U.S.-based discount retailer Dollar General has opened its 20,000th store, celebrating the occasion in Alice, Texas. The grand opening celebrations were attended by senior leaders and vendors. Dollar General Executive Vice President of Store Operations and Development, Steve Deckard, commented, "We believe each store provides a positive impact in our hometowns through convenient access to affordable essentials, career growth, opportunities for employees, and the ability for local nonprofits, schools, and libraries to advance through Dollar General Literacy Foundation grants." Dollar General also awarded $20,000 to support educational and tutoring programs through donations to a local library and community group, as well as providing new books to a local elementary school. Dollar General employs more than 17,500 Texas employees through its store, distribution center, and private fleet presence in the state. On to you, Sri.
Thank you, Melissa and Peter. Jessica Alba has actually stepped down as Chief Creative Officer of The Honest Company, a company she founded. So after nearly 12 years of the company, Alba shared the news in an Instagram post on Tuesday, April 9th. "It is with grateful heart that 12 years after founding The Honest Company, I'm stepping down from my leadership role as CCO. However, I will continue to provide strategic advice through my role on the board," Alba wrote. What's next, Peter?
Oreo reimagines ubiquitous internet menu icon to dole out discounts. Mondelez international brand Oreo has launched a commerce activation dubbed the Oreo menu that aims to re-envision the internet's ubiquitous three-line hamburger menu navigation tool as a two-stacked Oreo cookies. Key to the effort is a microsite where consumers can enter any tab or category name they see when clicking on the three-bar menu icon on the internet as a promo code to receive a deal for Oreo cookies that can be redeemed at Kroger as part of an exclusive partnership. The activation includes an explanatory video and is being driven by influencer content along with digital and social media to drive engagement. The effort follows Oreo's first Super Bowl ad in a decade earlier this year. Andrea, what do you have to close us out?
Hello, Fresh Four listeners. Shein has copyright infringement baked into its business model. Shein is facing a class action lawsuit that alleges that the fast fashion company uses an industrial scale scheme of systematic digital copyright infringement against small designers and artists, according to court documents last week. Attorneys for the group of plaintiffs say that Shein uses sophisticated electronic systems that algorithmically scour the internet for popular works created by artists and misappropriates these works to manufacture and sell them as Shein products without attribution to the creators. The complaint is the latest in a series of copyright infringement lawsuits filed against the fast fashion giant, including an ongoing one from last year that claimed violation of the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organization Act.
Thank you, Andrea. That's it for the Fresh Four. Now on to the CPG Guys episode that you've downloaded.
Welcome to another episode of the CPG Guys podcast. Our co-hosts, Sri Rajagopalan and Peter V.S. Bond, explore how brands and retailers engage with consumers online, in-store, and everywhere in between. And now, here are Sri and Peter.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the CPG Guys podcast. This is the second episode in our series with Stephen Coven. He's an e-commerce luminary with great experience at companies like Hormel most recently, and Henkel, and quite a number of others. So, Stephen, welcome back, and love to continue this conversation.
No, thank you.
In the first episode, we talked a lot about the basics of UGC. And UGC is, for our audience to remind you, is user-generated content, product ratings and reviews, images, videos, questions and answers, anything where the actual consumer is generating the content that can be shared to other consumers looking to make purchase decisions. So back to some questions. It's been my experience as I read reviews on sites like Amazon that many reviews are one or two words. Awesome, great, fantastic, horrible. That's not very helpful to a lot of brands. So can you talk about how a brand can go about generating more meaningful reviews that they can actually make better business decisions on?
No, absolutely. You know, it partially depends on the vehicle. So if you're, for instance, doing sampling, there are things that you could put in the, maybe it's in a box that you're shipping the product out, that you give them things to think about when they're writing the review. As we talked about in the first episode of this podcast, how you set up that form on your website to gain information can create triggers for them to think about, oh, I should maybe talk about fit if it's a garment. So also, you know, when you have the landing page, let's say you're doing a web-based reviews generation from a sweepstakes, you can provide communication that gets people thinking about what's important. And so, you know, showing maybe like this is a bad review, just saying awesome, and then showing what you're looking for, that there's maybe a paragraph of information. I think consumers are fine with getting a little bit of guidance to help them understand what is more valuable than not.
Stephen, can you go a little bit deeper into, you mentioned sampling. I know we talked about it in the last episode. What exactly is a sampling community? And what is it that they deliver to? What do you deliver to them, and what do they deliver to you in the writing of a review experience?
So for me, a sampling community involves access to people that are familiar with writing reviews.
Now, are these people like you see on YouTube? They're big social media influencers. I mean, who are these people?
These are generally maybe like entry bloggers or just consumers that like free stuff and want to talk about it.
So it could be like your next door neighbor. It could be your cousin, your sibling. It's everyday people who just
absolutely
like to write reviews. So what are you giving them to write that review?
So in it's in essence, and looking through the lens of the FTC, we're giving them a product for free. And in return, they're going to write an unbiased review about the product. Now, with a social or, you know, reviews community, you're able to access a community that knows what's going on here, that writing a review involves X, Y, and Z, that it's a trade per se, that they're getting a item, and in, you know, response, they'll write a review. What you also will get from the community is the ability to have a higher yield. So if we decided as a brand Y to send out 100 packages of our new chips to just randomly in the United States and said, write a review, you're going to have really low yield. But in a community setting, you're going to have people that are predisposed to knowing it's what we have to do because I signed up for this. I made an agreement. I'll be part of this community. I'll get free stuff, but I need to write a review. And so
if they don't write a review, Stephen, what ends up happening?
Well, my understanding is that, you know, they're less likely to get the products in the future. And so they know that it's good to write reviews, or they're going to be less likely to get something in the future. What I've not stated and expect either is that they're going to write a review that's positive or negative or anything in between. What we're looking for on the brand side, you know, trying to get a review is a review. we can't bias them. We can't say only, you know, anything below a five is I will get fired. No, this, you can't gain the actual rating. What we're looking for is high, I'll call it yield. And again, we'll probably talk about later is, you know, negative reviews are, yes, it's not fun to read them when you're on the brand, but they're very useful to the consumer to make a decision. Is this the product for me or not?
Yeah, at Power Reviews, we have a community of everyday influencers, like you described, your next door neighbor, your mom, your cousin, someone who sits next to you at work when you used to actually go to a physical workplace. And they understand that if they're getting these samples, they write reviews. If they don't write a review, they're probably not going to get selected for another campaign. And they like getting free stuff and they like trying new products. They actually think many of them, we've surveyed them, they actually think that they're doing a great service because they're helping people be informed on all of these new products. And that is a really compelling model. And the goal here is to be able to do that. So you mentioned yield. Our sampling community, our average yield is somewhere north of 85%. So that means for every 100 samples you send out, you're going to get back 85 reviews. So it makes it very easy to gauge, and that's pretty important. Let's actually, you mentioned negative reviews. Let's jump right to that, Stephen, because I think that's important. I hear all too often from brands, okay, how do I deal with negative reviews? Do I really have to display them? Shouldn't I just like push those aside and just focus? I mean, particularly I was talking with someone whose board was very concerned about negative reviews. And I'm sure you've heard that in your time. Should they be afraid of negative reviews? And how should brands deal with this kind of feedback? What should they not do? And also, what should they not do?
Yes. Wow. We could have a whole podcast on this topic.
So I think first, so too.
Yes. The word fear comes up. I've heard worse, not even shifting them down, but deleting them. No, that's not allowed. And so the reality is, if you're going to get into this space, you have to play with both the positives and the negatives of it. And the negatives of it are actually not as bad as people think. Because as you've stated before over the years, is feedback is a gift. And that gift can help in many ways. Number one, it could tell someone that this is maybe not the product for them. But that's not a bad thing. If it could also say it's the product for them. Let me give you the example. You are in the market of buying running shoes. And there's a one-star review, and you read it, and it says, well, this didn't work on rocky trails. But you as the consumer are like, I'm just going to use this on my treadmill. So this is fine. And so that one-star rating maybe is discounted by that consumer. They now know why it was rated low, and it doesn't apply to them. But we also have to remember that we don't want as brands and retailers to end up sending the wrong product. That doesn't help anyone. You're going to have a consumer that might do the return. They might not like the retailer because it's like, whoa, why did you send this? This, you guys aren't managing your SKUs right. So it's good to have that feedback out there so you can adjust to it. You can't hide from it. Another thing I always think about is the consumer's king. And so if it's not working, you now know that maybe your formula needs to be enhanced. It doesn't have the benefit. Maybe it needs to be lower sugar. Take this feedback, as you say, Peter, is this is a gift, and now you can adjust. And then you can even go back to those consumers. Let's say you do take the sugar level down. You can go and say, hey, we heard you, and write something in the updated, you know, moderation. That's going to create such loyalty. And so it is, in essence, par for the course. I hate to bring the lawyers in. It's, the FTC requires it. And so it's going to come through, you know, anyway. And so leverage it. It helps you. And then finally, you know, it always comes down to the product. I always say you can always get trial. Repeat's the hard part. So, you know, if your product's not great, you're going to have to fix it. You know, if you're sitting there at 3.5 stars, It's not the ratings that are the problem. It's your product, unfortunately.
That's true, Steve. And I was working with a very prominent personal care brand that we helped them analyze all of their ratings and reviews on Amazon. And the message that came back, while they had generally positive reviews, the negative reviews are almost always associated with the same topic. How people got frustrated with the plastic clamshell, frustrated packaging. And they were able to change that. And in 6 months, they saw a tremendous improvement in the reviews coming back. So it's very, very important that you pay attention to your point, not only to correct products, but to innovate. You'll find really great ideas. I saw a research study done by two professors, one at MIT and one at Northwestern, and they hypothesized that everything you get from a focus group, you can probably get by just reading readings and reviews on Amazon. And they found that 97% of the concepts for a number of categories they analyzed were all just already in the ratings and reviews. Why pay for all this expensive effort? But I also think there's an interesting way you can turn ratings and reviews from a negative to a positive. I saw one print ad in a magazine. It was a ski enthusiast magazine for a particular ski slope out in the Rockies, which is a very challenging ski slope. And they were highlighting a one-star review. And it was from someone saying, this hill is way too hard for an amateur. I couldn't possibly ski this. I would not recommend this for amateurs. And if you think about where they were advertising in a trade pub, in a publication that was clearly designed for people who like to ski double black diamonds. So really great way to turn something negative into something that attracted a particular type of consumer. But I will finally say that the research we have says that on a product page with ratings and reviews, the most desired component, the most utilized component of the rating and review section is when someone can click on the one star and just filter to your point. They want to understand how bad it is. If you don't offer that, they're not going to trust you as much. So it's better to deal with it.
Let me build on that trust aspect. People do not believe a perfect 5-star, 100 review product. It's just impossible. It's like winning the lottery. And so you're going to need negative reviews or something below a 5 per se to create that trust and authenticity. It's just the studies have been shown. I know the ones that you guys worked on with Northwestern. There is a decay in conversion after you get over 4.6. So it's just, it needs to be honest so then someone can leverage it. And, so it's not a bad thing to have negative reviews. Not everyone's going to be happy. That's just the world.
It's really in how you respond to it, what you learn from it. And if you do respond, at least respond, we've talked about this, respond to every negative review, regardless of whether it's valid or not, because you want to show back to your audience that the brand does have human beings working there and that you are responsive. That's what people look for.
Absolutely. Great.
I think we already established that having a UGC program for a brand is not a destination. It is a journey. So how should brands consider maintaining their UGC program over time? What are some things that they should be considering to ensure that the program actually delivers results?
Great question. I think there's two things at a high level to consider. One is you're going to need some sort of dashboard analytics to know where you're at. And within that, you're going to need to create some benchmarks against competition and other things. So this will help be your North Star on where you're heading when it comes to the creation, that maintenance of new reviews. And also within it is just understanding not just the quantity, but are things changing on the level? So all of a sudden, over a month period, you start getting a bunch of negative reviews. Well, something's changed. And so how do you now break down what is causing it? Was it someone changed the processing aspect and it created an impact to the end product? So you really got to be watching. This is like a beautiful, you know, dashboard of understanding, you know, are they liking it? And if something's changing. The second part is finding a partner, you know, working like with PowerViews or others in the sense of ensuring that you have that ongoing freshness, that more recency aspect of your reviews. And so you're going to need to have that, you know, as part of your organization and manage with your partners to ensure that you have, per se, that drip happening of all that ongoing review generation, ensure that you're keeping up with the Joneses.
Yeah, your UGC program, you need to think of it as a NORAD for your brand, right? It's an early warning system that something may be going wrong and you got to catch it there and address it pretty quickly because your consumers will tell you if there's a problem with your product.
One other thing that you've been a great advocate of is integrating it into other marketing touch points. So we've been talking a lot about on the PDP, but these consumers are giving great information that other consumers are interested in hearing and can influence them. So maybe it's a, you know, an ad that you show 5-star and a quote associated with it. So not just think through that maybe narrow lens of just ensuring that you have the conversion aspects and working the algorithm, but how do you take this amazing content from the voice that's trusted from a consumer? We know how important word of mouth is. And how do you start integrating that into something in store, a circular, or anything? And you really have this nice, you know, content to repurpose.
Yeah, if you think about the marketing funnel, the PDP is typically lower in the funnel where you're on the page and you're starting to look at it. But you can apply content all over the funnel. You mentioned awareness, right? Think about all the sponsored ads you see on Facebook and Instagram that have star ratings on them. That's about creating awareness and interest. That's much higher in the funnel. But you can even go down to the very bottom of the funnel, which is purchase. And if you think about it, how many times do you go onto a site, you add something to the basket, and then you get busy, you go away, you abandon it? Cart abandonment is one of the biggest issues for e-commerce retailers. A lot of them have built in the capability to say, hey, you left something in the basket. Maybe you want to go back and buy it. Well, why do they want to buy it? Well, you probably want to buy it because it's rated 4.5 out of 5 stars and there are 1,000 reviews. That can be a really effective way to do it. So there are all sorts of places up and down the funnel that you can use UGC.
And absolutely. And you know, you maybe think about direct to consumer and smaller companies out there.
Yep.
You know, if you're starting off, you don't have the tens of millions of dollars to create that equity, but you might be very good at driving people to your website. But what happens is, you know, now the rubber meets the road. Are they willing to put that credit card in and buy, as you talked about, abandonment? So what can you do to create trust that this is a reputable company and the product works or is good? And so you're not going to be able to do that overnight with equity, you know, unless you're funded by some VC that wants to put a Super Bowl ad up. But you can, through ratings and reviews, put in, you know, that trust factor by just having 100 reviews.
Well, let's talk about more about what you do with those reviews and how you learn from them. If Sri were here, he'd tell you that the way he tried to make sense of all the content that was out there, be it on his brand sites or on retailer sites, was a little haphazard. He'd typically hire a bunch of summer interns and give them a project to read a lot of reviews and come back and tell me what it means. And the problem at the end of the day is that's neither scalable nor is it objective. I think you would agree with me on that. So in 2021, what should brands be doing to learn from UGC on their products, on their competitors' products? Are there tools and mechanisms that can help you do that more efficiently now than hiring an army of interns and hoping that they find some of the nuggets that might be buried in there? And in all likelihood, it's like going after a needle in a haystack.
Yes. So first is leveraging your, you know, provider's analytics tools. And obviously, you know, working with PowerViews, you've got a great dashboard and analytics available. And you want to maximize that. You want to make sure your team has access and you maybe have some sort of cadence weekly or something that you're getting in there and really getting the nuggets of what's happening. Secondly is broaden it and look at, I'll say, offsite search. You know, so we're talking the Google and Bing type search here, is using SEO optimization tools and see what's happening when it comes to UGC. You know, is there stuff that's coming up in, you know, a page rank that now you should be thinking about? Is there a trend here? Is looking what's trending on YouTube or social platforms? So you can broaden UGC beyond just, and obviously you want to start with, you know, your reviews, because that's where you're focused, but looking beyond that to things that are happening on the Googles of the world, but then also even on the retailer sites, there's tools to look to see what's happening and changing and trending. And so there's a lot of information. You just have to be selective and pragmatic about it, but you can really decipher a lot of things and be ahead in the sense of, okay, this is more important now. Let's make sure that's highlighted. Or we maybe need to go source some UGC relating to, you know, this garment with jeans. So lots of opportunity here to really maximize this effort.
That's great. Thank you, Stephen. When I think about helping brands with understanding the content, they all have different needs, right? Amazon is more often than not a major concern. But there are other sites. Pet food manufacturers want to understand sites like Chewy, where baby manufacturers may want to understand what's going on Bye Bye Baby. And so having a partner that can scrape content from just about any site that's out there and then run it through UGC analytics tools that they can make sense of it at scale and track it over time is very valuable for brands, and it helps them gain a competitive advantage over their competitors in the space.
Absolutely. And, you know, when you have a platform that can do the scraping and also has the syndicated, you know, on-brand generation, you can pull that all together and really have a bigger sample size to make decisions. Yeah. And that's really important when you have a new item, because you might only have like 100 here and 100 there. You need that aggregation to really quickly understand, you know, is this one that the formula is fine, or do we need to adjust? Do we need to adjust the advertising? So like anything, having more is better in this situation, so you can make more accurate decisions.
Okay. Now let's talk to something that you mentioned in our first episode, Stephen, which is brands generate a lot of content and they don't just display it on their site. Their goal is to expand the application of that content to some of their retail partners. So can you describe to the audience what is this concept called syndication? Whenever I hear syndication, first time I heard it, it sounds like a very nefarious word, like syndication. But what does it mean, and why exactly is it important to brands?
So, you know, content is king. Then the queen is syndication. So it's great to have content, but if it's not seen, it's not valuable. So syndication is about taking, for instance, a review that's been generated on your brand page and ensuring that it gets to as many retail pages as possible and can also be integrated to social tools and such. So syndication is really another way to talk about it is the transportation or porting of a review to another destination. And to do that, you need a partner like PowerViews, for instance, to be able to go on their network. They have connections with retail sites that allows that review on your site, brand Y, to go get syndicated to mass retailers, dollar retailers, drug retailers, club, and beyond. So it's so important that you have that marriage between the king and the queen, where you have really a dysfunctional family.
And I think the real power there, Stephen, is there's some sausage making going on in the background, for lack of a better term, right? In order for that to happen, the brand has its products, a retailer has its. And sometimes it's as simple as they have the same UPC And so we can connect that. But we talked in the last episode about this concept of variance, different sizes. And so being able to make sure that your platform provider is matching your content with retailers' content is critical for your content to get the maximum reach. And so there are categories where you can't do it that easily. One that comes to mind is tires. Do you remember ever seeing a UPC on a tire? Probably not, because do you ever actually go and pick the tire up and take it to a cash register and scan it? No, you go into a tire store and everything happens behind the counter. They bring it up on the computer and they charge you for it. So I come to find out that most tire manufacturers don't have UPCs. And so matching it requires that you have a partner that will deal with what do I do in those kind of cases. So in the case of PowerViews, we actually have a multi-step matching process. We start with automation to capture as much as we can. But sometimes that's just not enough because either the retailer doesn't have UPCs in their system or the manufacturer doesn't even generate UPCs. So now you actually have to have experts in matching that can ensure the content does get from one to the other. And if you don't have that with your partner, guess what? Your content's not going to reach there. And your goal is to get that content attributed on the manufacturer's site so that all your items have content and that that content can help accelerate the path to purchase.
Yeah, it's even worse in my recommendation per se is when you have the wrong ratings or reviews being syndicated to a product, it's almost better to just have nothing. Because you've just set up this confusion like, well, why is it talking about this when it has nothing to do about it? And so you've just created concern on the consumer and they're like, well, I don't know if I'm going to buy it now because which one is it? Am I getting the apple filling or the cherry filling? And it's talking about apple, but I'm trying to buy cherry. So maybe I'll go buy someone else's. So you don't want to have that misalignment. And it's so important to have a partner that you're right, that is ensuring that things are syncing up correctly, because you every piece of the chain has to work or the system falls apart.
So I've got a follow-up question for you on this concept of syndication, Stephen. There's a lot of change going on and talk in the industry about monetizing this syndication or flow of content from a brand to a retailer, and ultimately for consumption by a consumer. What's going on there? And do you see that as being good for retailers, brands, and consumers in this process?
Great question. You know, I'm sort of looking through my lens of the consumer is king. And so I start there. And, you know, if we use Jeff Bezos as the example that you want to create a absolutely best in class consumer experience, then having a upcharge to move content would be against that. Because at the highest level, the content is helping what the retailer or the brand is trying to do. They're trying to sell more. They're trying to put the right product in that basket. And if you put up a toll booth that stops the content, that allows them to know more, create higher conversion, reduce returns, you've created an inefficiency there. Now, yes, you can say to, if you're on the retailer side, that we're making X amount of money and that helps the bottom line. But that's, for me, is a little bit more of a short-term view. The end game is the consumer having a great experience and selling more. And so for me, I think that toll ends up creating an inefficiency that, you know, blocks the ability for, you know, the information needed to make a better site. Now, I know if I'm on the retailer side, I've got to make my number. I've got investments on e-commerce. But I would say charge somewhere else, or hopefully not charge anything, but don't block the flow of information because, again, content's king. And so again, just an inefficiency, I think that I'd love for it to go away.
Is it the retailer that's charging this? And if it isn't, where are the funds being sourced to pay for these tolls or access fees?
So, you know, some vendors in the space that do syndication, you know, they do have tolls, and I don't know if they're doing a profit sharing with the other retailer. So you're right. It might not just be driven by the retailer. It's driven by the SaaS company that is putting up that toll. But in my mind, it's an inefficiency. I am an advocate of the open network to allow the free flowing of reviews, UGC and beyond. And in essence, try to find the revenue somewhere else, but content does help the end goal. So why block it?
Oftentimes that the brand paying for that, they source it, since it's going to a specific retailer, they source it from a trade fund. And as a result of that, it's like taking money out of the retailer's pocket, not just doing that. And what ends up happening is only the biggest brands can afford to pay those fees. And that means that small nascent brands can't. And that's usually where you get the growth, right? Those are the ones that you want content on. You want to learn about these new products. That'll drive better conversion. And so making sure you're doing that. So it's a bit of a challenge, but
yeah, and it comes back to that customer P&L. So if you're on the brand side and you're looking at all the cost to serve, you've now layered on one more thing. And if you're the brand side, you're like, okay, this, maybe I don't focus as much on this retailer. It's going to take probably more things, but it's just one more piece on the camel's back to say, maybe we don't want to go more with or deeper with retailer, you know, B, because it's just inefficient. And let's focus on someone that has less fees and is more profitable.
So, I think that's a very good point. You need, as a brand, then you need to make judicious decisions. There are certain sites where that particular retailer may be critically important and you may decide it's worth investing. But there are other retailers that, while they are important to you from a brick and mortar perspective, their contribution to e-commerce is not that strong. And you may just decide, I'm not going to pay to share to that retailer. And that ends up hurting their e-commerce business even more. It doesn't support it. And that's unfortunate. So yeah.
And then there's lost sales and there's a bad consumer experience. They're expecting that as a, you know, why they're on the site, they're going to learn more and you have less for them to learn from. It, I would say those that are doing that toll are not getting 100% of compliance. I'd say it's extremely low and everyone else is just not sending the content. So I think that shows that it's a broken system.
Well, I can tell you this, retailers are starting to pick up on this and moving to platforms where those kinds of, yeah, there are things about charging fees to do that matching and to do the content moderation, but simply for access to a retailer that may use a SaaS platform's solutions, they're not really happy about that. And they're making decisions about circumventing that particular obstruction. So
well, that's great news. Great news.
Let's get to a happy place, Stephen, because that was a bit of a, that was a bit of a sad place. Couple last questions I have for you, because we've been talking mostly about ratings and reviews. We made some references to other things, but what about this concept of questions and answers? Should brands offer Q&A on their sites? And should they build a plan that they are not only responding to their questions on their sites, should they think about responding to questions that appear on retailer sites?
Absolutely. When we think about FAQs, it's, again, par for the course. Consumers expect, because if we look through the Amazon lens, they've had that. They're used to getting that type of information. And so if you're not doing that on the retailer page, you're not doing it on your brand page, you're missing out on helping the consumer convert. And so, you know, you're going to need to make that investment on creating that guide to be able to answer them. Obviously, key questions and information you want to put into the copy of your PDP, but you can't answer everything in the PDP, and there's more specific ones. So that's the opportunity to be ready if it does pop up to answer it on, let's say, a retailer site, but absolutely critical UGC. And I think as algorithms get better and source more, you know, information into the calculations on what should come in a page results of a search, you're going to see FAQs becoming more important.
All right. That's very helpful. Let's also talk about this visual content. We mentioned the selfie, but you also brought up video being an increase. I mean, think about how important video is in social applications like TikTok, right? What is the importance of visual content in consumer-generated content, and how can brands go about ensuring that they are collecting this content in addition to, or even in some cases, as the primary output of a solicitation effort?
Visual is so critical. In some categories, it's literally essential to get an idea of what's the color, size, you know, does it work well with other things? We're humans. We like to look at things versus reading. It takes less neurons to do that. So having it for certain categories, especially like in the home hardware, apparel, you can do it into the food space, showing recipes. You really can help motivate and create that conversion. And not only motivate, it's essential. I've recently done some remodeling and to make sure this fits and looks right. You can only get that from a lot of UGC. There's limitations on the tiles available on the product page. So there's 10, but it doesn't show it, in this situation. You're hoping when you go down to the range of reviews that someone's uploaded to see, does it fit in the situation in the installation, for instance?
If you think about a platform like YouTube, they built their existence on UGC. It's contributions. I mean, I pretty much fix everything in my car by going to YouTube and looking for someone who recorded a video to show me how to change the cabin light or how to change the headlight or where to find a particular part of the car. So, very important.
Absolutely a resource, and you nailed it, is that's the second most, trafficked search, site in the U.S. And so understanding how's this look, how's it work, that is all UGC that really influences the consumer and the purchase.
I'm going to remind our audience that all of our content can be found on cpgguys.com, and you can go there or you can go to LinkedIn, either place, and look for the CPG Guys on LinkedIn. If you go to LinkedIn, not through the CPG Guys site, just type in CPG Guys and you'll find our page. Follow us and you'll see we post a lot of interesting content there. You can see our weekly Fresh 4 video where we talk about 4 intriguing news stories. And our founders series that's been going on in the first quarter of 2021, all of that available on cpgguys.com. Stephen, I really want to thank you for joining me on this 2-part episode arc. I'm really grateful for your insights and opinions. Very excited about that. And I know we're going to have to find a way to continue working with you on this. That there's a lot of interesting stuff. I know you have some particular expertise in different marketing technical applications and SaaS platforms. So I know I'm going to be tapping you as a resource going forward. Thank you. And we look forward to working with you.
I'd love to come back, and it's been great doing this. And obviously as someone that's listened to almost every one of the podcasts, just such good information with Sri and your guests. So it's great to be a part of it and pay it forward. I've learned a lot. And, I'm going to put a plug in for some UGC. So ratethispodcast.com/CPGguys. Let's get to 100.
So I like it. I like it.
And obviously, I know Peter and Sri, they read these to help guide the content. So, let's show what UGC is all about.
I'm going to, in the liner notes of the podcast, even I'm going to put a link to your LinkedIn profile. And I would encourage our guests to follow Stephen because he posts a lot of great content. You'll also probably, that'll be the first place we'll find out where Stephen's going next. So very exciting. Thank you again for joining us, Stephen.
Thank you.
All right. To our audience, we want to thank you for continuing to join us on this journey. And we look forward to speaking with you on the next episode of the CPG Guys podcast. Thanks. Have a great day. The content in this podcast episode is provided for general informational purposes only. By listening to our episode, you understand that no information contained in this episode should be construed as advice from CPG Guys LLC or the individual author, hosts, or guests, nor is it intended to be a substitute for research on any subject matter. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by CPG Guys LLC. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. The views expressed by CPG Guys LLC do not represent the views of their employers or the entity they represent. CPG Guys LLC expressly disclaims any and all liability or responsibility for any direct, indirect, incidental, special, consequential, or other damages arising out of any individual's use of, reference to, or inability to use this podcast or the information we present in this podcast.